Apologize for the delay due to the technology, which will become ironic as you'll see from the lecture. I'm going to be lecturing today mostly, actually entirely, about Eliot's The Wasteland. But most of what I say about that poem, which is still the most famous work in Eliot's career, can be applied generally to the poems in your selected edition. One of the signal commands of modern art is given by Sergei Diaghilev, the impresario of the Russian ballets in the early part of the 20th century, when he said to poet and librettist Jean Cocteau, "Étonnez-moi, astonish me." 88 years after its publication, The Wasteland still has the power to astonish with its modernity. And this is itself astonishing because we stand in the same relation to the year of Eliot's poem as he himself did to the year 1835, when William Wordsworth published his now mostly forgotten volume, Yarrow Revisited. Now, this is not to say that the arresting works of literature from any era don't retain the power to astonish us, but rather that The Wasteland still manages to surprise us as a modern poem. It is recognizably modern in a way that much poetry published today is not. And this should give us pause. Why is it that when we open the pages of, take your pick, the Times Literary Supplement, the Observer, the Review on Saturday, why is it that when we look at poems published in those periodicals, we don't see something that seems to build upon the achievements of Eliot's Wasteland, published early in the 20th century? Instead, seems much closer, in fact, to Wordsworth than what we get with Eliot's brand of modernism. We need to think about why this is so. It's worth comparing poetry in this regard to other media. Think about the visual arts. Think about painting, and think about music as well. In those cases, the situation is quite different. The kinds of pieces that you hear in the so-called classical music world today and in the visual arts, in painting, sculpture, installation art, conceptual art, and so on, seem recognizably linked to the pioneering modernist innovations of the early 20th century in a way that poetry tends not to. Let me give you a couple of examples. Eliot's poem stands in relation to modern poetry in pretty much the same way that Picasso's Demoiselle d'Avignon stands in relation to modern painting. This painting announces the shock of the new with unparalleled force. And to this day, the way that Picasso broke with the conventions of representational or mimetic painting in oils stands as a marker of just how radical his re-envisioning of the possibilities of the medium actually turns out to be. Similarly, the musical counterpart to The Wasteland is probably Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, an excerpt of which I'll play right now. Sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, it's interesting that both the Picasso and the Stravinsky are premised on the yoking of the radically new, the contemporary, with the primitive. Picasso's painting, ostensibly a picture of prostitutes in D'Avignon, superimposes on the faces of three of them the look of African masks, which Picasso had become very interested in at the time, as an exemplar of the kind of energy and force that he found missing in so much so-called Western art of his day. Similarly, Stravinsky takes what sound like the sounds, like the noises of the urban modern, the squeals of brakes, the sounds of traffic, and fuses them as almost like an X-ray with the primitive rites of fertility ritual in his native Russia. And I think we want to bookmark both of those in looking at the wasteland, because Eliot, too, is interested in the union or the forced fusion of the primitive and the modern, with some attention to the role of sexuality and fertility. I'll just say parenthetically, the Stravinsky excerpt, somebody's written in the comments, they're always interesting in YouTube, somebody's written, wow, I had no idea that 20th century classical composers had a badass in their midst. And somebody down below says, this is where metal began. You could argue, in fact, that Eliot's poem is the badass of modern poetry in English, and that he, too, brings something like the energy of metal into modern poetry. Okay. Well, one of the first questions we have to ask here is, what's the source of the surprise in Eliot's poem today? Let us consult the wisdom of Wikipedia. The poem is known for its obscure nature, its slippage between satire and prophecy, its abrupt changes of speaker, location, and time, its elegiac but intimidating summoning up of a vast and distant range of cultures and literatures. Despite this, it has become a touchstone of modern literature. Or you could say, because of this, it has become a touchstone of modern literature. You note how the anti-modernism of so much literary discourse surrounding at least English language experimentation seems to be premised on the notion that, you know, if a poem does all of these crazy things, then it can't possibly be considered a classic or a touchstone. It is somehow aberrant or anomalous. And so it is in our literary history to this day. The descriptor terms that are used when coming to terms with Eliot's poems and poem and his effects in the poem have a kind of family resemblance. Discontinuous, disjunct, fragmented, elusive, polyvocal, and the violence that comes with polyvocality. All of these are ways of describing the effect of the poem. Now, it's no accident that this should be so. One of the early drafts of The Wasteland had as its title, He Do the Police in Different Voices, which is from Dickens's novel, Our Mutual Friend. The character says, you mightn't think it, but Sloppy is a beautiful reader of a newspaper. He do the police in different voices. And of course, Eliot does not just the police, but a whole range of contemporary characters, mostly urban, in putting together the collage that is The Wasteland. And when we talk about this poem, one of the first things that we encounter is a kind of crux, a kind of decision that you have to make as a reader when navigating this apparently incommensurate collage of different voices and different effects, different linguistic textures. This crux is often described in Eliot criticism as the one narrator versus many narrators debate. Is there a single narratorial consciousness in The Wasteland which gives rise to the plot of the poem? That is to say, its witness of a breakdown in post-war European civilization? Or is there instead a plurality of speakers who keep dissolving into one another in such a way as to refuse the mastery or authority of a single overriding voice? Here, I should probably make a personal admission. I myself have great difficulty with the plot of The Wasteland. I detest it, in fact. I find it reactionary and at least borderline racist, lugubrious in its aspects of satire and a kind of near hysterical reaction in its fear of the variously figured other, you know, whether that is the other of other cultures, the other of the female gender, the other of other sexualities, and so forth. It is also neurotically pessimistic about modernity and deeply anhedonic in its approach to modern sexuality. Fortunately, however, and that's why I'm here today, The Wasteland is more than its plot. In fact, you could say that what saves the poem is the way that it loses the plot, surrenders the obsession of maintaining control over its materials, and lets those materials speak in their own compellingly various voices. So you will see that I am a subscriber to the many voices theory of approaches to the poem, though I shouldn't let that dissuade you from making the other case. In fact, I think that kind of a debate would be very useful to have in seminars. Do you, in fact, buy the voice of authority so compellingly encoded in Eliot's notes at the end of the poem, which seem to suggest that the whole thing is all a plan that he had in mind from the beginning, in which the various voices and multifarious allusions all come together in some kind of conjuncture and resolution? Or are you more skeptical about that claim as a kind of retrospective or retroactive claim for coherence? Do you rather suspect that what drives Eliot's poem is the energy of its disjunctions, its fragmentations, its variously pulled together allusions? However you decide, we need to confront the way in which the Wasteland has come down to us, primarily under the first heading rather than the second. In the notorious notes that he later added to The Wasteland, really to pad it out to make a book, because a poem of only 17 or 18 pages wasn't sufficient to justify publication on its own, so Eliot decided he would add these explanatory notes to flesh out the page numbers. Eliot, in these notes, makes Tiresias, the blind prophet from part three of the poem, who experienced life as both man and woman, the retrospective protagonist of the entire poem. All the men, says Eliot, in the poem are one man, all the women, one woman, united in the figure of Tiresias. But as scholarship has shown, the arc of the Wasteland's composition, which is legible in the facsimile edition of the manuscript published by Eliot's wife, Valerie, in 1971, tells a different story. The poem began as a series of fits and starts, scraps of pastiche that he hadn't necessarily considered including in a longer work, fragments that went nowhere or were too obvious, bits of earlier verse that Eliot liked but he couldn't necessarily justify including. All of these stages in the composition of the poem point to the lack of an overriding plan. What happened to make The Wasteland The Wasteland was decisive, and it came in the form of the editorial intervention of Ezra Pound, his friend and fellow poet. Pound's edits transformed the poem from start to finish, and if you want to see how radical they are, you must consult the facsimile edition, which shows all the bits that Eliot left in before Pound got at the manuscript and reduced it to its current and much reduced form. Okay. For the rest of the lecture, what I want to do is examine three aspects of Eliot's work, in order to ask more general questions about the relation of literature to the modern world, the theme of the module. And I'm going to end by suggesting a way in which we can think of Eliot's work in relation to the modern world in ways that don't necessarily have to do with its content, but rather with its form. And not just the form of its fragmentation, but the form as it relates to social content. Okay. Here's the first question that I think we should ask. How does modern writing respond to the circumstances of its production? And how can we read this retrospectively? In other words, how is The Wasteland a poem of the early 1920s, and how does that matter to us now? Why should we care? Second question is, how should we understand an aesthetic of quotation, which is so obviously the central poetic technique that Eliot employs? How should we understand this aesthetic of citation as specifically modern? Can we read The Wasteland as a product of multiple collaborations, and in what ways? And third, how does modern literature position itself in relation to other ways of registering or encoding the modern? In other words, what kind of cultural technology does poetry become with The Wasteland? Poetry, maybe, becomes more than just a different and radically looking, a different looking thing on the page. With Eliot and the generation of Eliot's modernist peers, poetry becomes a different kind of thing in relation to its audience, in relation to the horizon of significance it might have in the culture. How does it, you might say, compete with other such media, especially the newer media of the 20th century? Okay. Three contexts, then, for considering the poem. Let's look at them in turn. The first, post-war history. Now, last week, you looked at the poems of Edward Thomas. You did, didn't you? And you read them in light of Thomas's involvement and reflection on the experience of war. With The Wasteland, we have not directly a war poem, but instead one registering the surge of energy and confusion and displacement in the wake of war, including the toppling of previous world power centers. This is, after all, the era of the implosion of world empires, the Russian, the Austro-Hungarian, the Ottoman, some of them very ancient indeed, stretching back centuries, whose fragments were now literally scattered across the landscape of Europe in the wake of the war, and whose fragments were being recomposed and stitched together in alternate ways through the Treaty of Versailles and the peace agreements that concluded it. One of the most overwhelming things that we take from The Wasteland, I think, is the degree to which there is no power center in the poem. Instead, there is something very like a power vacuum. Authority seems to have left the scene. We have the departed Citibank directors, the heirs of capital. We have the archdukes from the beginning of the poem. The heirs and the broken Coriolanus and the wounded Fisher King. All such figures of authority seem to have gone, leaving what in their wake? I think it's worth noting that Eliot originally used as an epigraph a quotation from Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, the famous passage citing Kurtz's last words, "The horror, the horror." Eventually, Pound persuaded him to drop that as an epigraph, and he substituted the one that we have now. But it is worth, again, pondering on the implications of that quotation. You are going to encounter Kurtz in the Heart of Darkness at the end of the year. But remember now that Eliot uses those words in part as a recognition not just of the implosion of imperial authority, but its revelation as a species of barbarism. Kurtz, the emissary of empire in the so-called heart of darkness that is Africa, is revealed to be more savage than any of the so-called savages surrounding him. This is 1921 when Eliot is writing the poem. It's a year of civil strife across the globe. In Ireland, militancy taking over after the Easter Uprising, preceding partition, a civil war that would have devastating consequences. In Russia, starvation and continuing civil war after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Even in Britain, the rise of working class militancy led to a wave of strikes, including a coal strike in that year that was to presage the Great Strike of 1926, about which you'll learn more when you come to Henry Green's Living. This landscape of shattered tradition and authority is very well described by Eliot's peer, John Maynard Keynes, now best known as the economist who addresses the Great Depression in the 30s, but at this time was a representative at the Treaty of Versailles deliberations and wrote about them shortly thereafter in The Economic Consequences of the Peace, a book from 1919. Here's Keynes in Paris. Paris was a nightmare, and everyone there was morbid. A sense of impending catastrophe overhung the frivolous scene, the futility and smallness of man before the great events confronting him, the mingled significance and unreality of the decisions. Levity, blindness, insolence, confused cries from without. So this scene of chaos and confusion and displaced authority is what Keynes is registering in the way in which the leaders of post-war Europe are trying to carve up what's left of the moribund empires and reassign them to their own. It is a period of inflation, mass unemployment, and significantly middleman profiteering. Now, this comes close to where Eliot lives, because he, at the time of the writing of the poem, is a clerk at Lloyd's Bank in London. And you can read The Wasteland as a poem that both registers the effects of the raging peace, as Michael Levinson memorably calls it. The scholar Michael Levinson is describing how the peace is as destructive, in Eliot's view, as the war that preceded it. This was a peace that came in pieces and later fell to pieces, of course, in the 1930s with the rise of the Nazis. But you can read The Wasteland as anti-finance in many ways because of the way of the destructiveness of international capital flows and financial dealing in its effects on the social polity. It might be worth pointing out, too, that Eliot, as an anti-bank banker at the time, made more money from his poetry in the year this poem was written than he did as a banker. It's probably the last time that will ever happen. What does Eliot describe for us in terms of the social scene, the effects of this raging peace? There are demobbed crowds flooding through the streets of London. And what's significant about them is the way that they mirror the ghostly crowds of the dead from the war. The sense of modern life as a shell or a husk without meaning, given the cataclysm that it has inherited, is very palpable in almost every line of the poem. And the question becomes, in the absence of authority, of any kind of traditional authority, where to turn for ways of ordering what Eliot calls in his review of Ulysses the immense futility of contemporary history? That's a question that has led some scholars to subscribe to the one voice or monovocal or single consciousness theory, that Eliot is really trying to write a kind of comfort note for himself in the end, even as he very pessimistically diagrams the fallout of the war and its effect in Europe. Let's turn instead, though, to our second question, the question of collaboration. Now, you know that the poem is dedicated to Pound's intervention, il miglior fabbro, the better maker, as Eliot calls him. And really, the centrality of Ezra Pound to any consideration of English literature in the modern world would mean that we would be reading him alongside of Eliot. In fact, you could say that we really are. The poem, in some ways, should have Pound under the byline as much as Eliot. And if we think about the implications of this, we begin to see that it might be worthwhile decentering the single author view of English literary history, whereby poems, novels, great works are written by master figures, the inspired single poet, and instead recognize in its place the inevitability of collaboration in all writing. What if we saw writing as fundamentally, not just superficially, but fundamentally collaborative? How would that change the way that we read? We usually pay lip service to this notion when we describe the genesis of various works. But in practice, we tend to reduce an English curriculum, at least, to a parade of single names. And our intensive investment in great man biography can sometimes divert our attention from the fact that all forms of cultural making are intrinsically social. So what did Pound and Eliot share as co-authors, if you like, of The Wasteland? Well, they didn't just share a modernist aesthetic. They also shared some less salubrious features of modern attitude, including a pronounced strain of anti-Semitism, which would, of course, become virulent in Pound's case in the decades that followed. And you could argue that this anti-Semitism wasn't simply accidental or peripheral or casual, but instead central to their worldviews. The scholar Anthony Julius has made this claim in his book on T.S. Eliot and anti-Semitism. In Pound's case, anti-Semitism was a source of hatred for the wrong kind of cosmopolitanism, precisely the kind associated with financial speculation, which he took to be dominated by Jews. But aside from this commonality in worldview between Eliot and Pound, we also see in their collaboration a shared fascination for the bottomless well of citational sources that is literary tradition itself. Now, you wouldn't know it from most curricula in English departments, but the centrality of a kind of self-conscious artifice of collage, in which you take things from different sources and simply juxtapose them rather than attempt to reproduce, represent, or mimetically copy them, is absolutely central to art practice in the 20th century. Again, if you think about Picasso, who pioneered the form of taking, you know, scraps of newspaper and making collage, and when you think about the use of citationality in other media, artistic media, it becomes readily apparent that collage is the working principle of much 20th century art. T.S. Eliot, in a famous essay, which you have probably come across in the past, Tradition and the Individual Talented, is rightly famous for claiming that tradition cannot be inherited. It is not something that you have passed down to you as in a natural form of inheritance from parent to child. Instead, tradition must be invented. And in fact, it is inevitable that tradition is invented any time a writer attempts to encounter the resources of the past. Tradition in the Individual Talent is essentially a model for a dialectics of collaboration across periods, across historical eras. And this is where we can see Eliot making use of his grasp of a modern aesthetic of citationality. How does this work then in terms of poetry as a kind of cultural technology. Okay. About 5 years ago, I was teaching The Wasteland and made the claim to my class that if you wanted to understand what was so unusual about the effect of the poem when it was first published, you needed to think about the radio. Instead of looking, as Eliot later said, to all the wild goose chases involving Jesse Weston's From Ritual to Romance and Fraser's The Golden Bough and its various anthropological sources and the numerous trails that he leaves in the notes appended to the poem, instead of looking there for an understanding, a grasp of the radical disjunctiveness and elusiveness of the poem, it might be better to think about what happens when, in the old days, you'd had a radio band and turned the dial of the radio through various bandwidths of white noise, eventually tuned into a channel, heard something, then tuned past, then heard another channel, then tuned past, and so forth. A student picked up on this idea and ended up writing a brilliant undergraduate thesis on Eliot and his use of the radio and the radio as a context for his work. And he didn't just write the thesis. He went as a participant at Radio Warwick and made a radio version of The Wasteland, which I'll play for you now. You may not agree with all of Jimmy's choices in the way that he's framed this thing, but I think what you will agree is that conceiving of the poem in this way retains something of its modernity in a way that source hunting does not.
People of the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and design, stirring dull roots with spring rain. Winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow, feeding a little life with dried tubers. Summer surprised us, coming over the Starnbergsee, the shower of rain. We stopped in the colonnade and went on in sunlight into the hot garden and drank coffee and talked long.
Ich bin gar keine Russin. Ich stamme aus Litauen. Ich tue.
And when we were children, David the Archduke, my cousin, he took me out in the sled and I was frightened. He said, Marie, Marie, hold on tight. And down we went to the mountains. They were free. I read much of it.
What are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Son of man, you cannot say or guess, for you know only a heap of broken images where the sun beats and the dead tree gives no shelter, cricket no relief, and the dry stone no sound of water. Only there is shadow under this red rock. Come in under the shadow of this red rock. And I will show you something different from either your shadow at morning, striding behind you, or your shadow at evening, rising to meet you. I will show you fear in a handful of doubt.
The Wagner.
He gave me hyacinths first a year ago. They called me the hyacinth girl.
Yeah, when we came back, late, in the hyacinth garden, your arms full and your hair wet, I could not speak, and my eyes failed. I was neither living nor dead, and I knew nothing. Looking into the heart of light, the planets.
Thank you. Madame the Sostress, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold. Nevertheless, is known to be the wisest woman in Europe, with a wicked pack of cards.
Here,
said she,
is your card. The drowned Phoenician sailor.
Those are pearls that were his eyes. Look.
Here is Belladonna, the lady of the rocks, the lady of situations. Here is the man with three staves, and here the wheel. And here is the one-eyed merchant. And this card.
And this card, which is blank, is something he carries on his back, which I forbid him to see. I do not find the hanged man.
Fear death by water. I see crowds of people walking round in the ring. Thank you. If you see dear Mrs. Equitone, tell her I bring the horoscope myself. One will be so careful these days.
In Rio City, under the brown fog of a winter dawn, a crowd flowed over London Bridge. So many, I had not thought death had undone so many. Sighs, short and frequent were exhaled, and each man fixed his eyes before his feet, flowed up the hill and down King William Street, to where St. Mary Woolworth Peppy lies, with a dead sound and a final stroke of nine. There I saw one I knew and stopped him. Cried, Stetson,
you, who are with me, this is coming up.
That cold she planted last year in my garden has it begun to sprout?
Okay. There's more to that version, and in the past I've posted the files onto the LMW website. Maybe I'll be able to do that again this year, because I think it's very illuminating to hear the way in which these different sources, and they are sound sources, are used in the wasteland, and in the way in which they switch from one channel to the other, as it were. Well, what does this kind of an experiment do for us in terms of trying to read, or more importantly, hear the wasteland's collage of fragments? A little bit of historical context. The BBC begins broadcasting in the year that The Wasteland is published. And the cultural presence of early radio caused all kinds of ramifications, both in the culture at large and society at large, but also in terms of literary culture. There were great fears at the time over the potential power of this new mass media. And it's no accident that dystopias like Brave New World emerge in the wake of the advent of radio. John Wraith, the initial managing director of the BBC, was so concerned about the potential abuse of radio that he was famous for instituting a kind of higher-brow regimen of cultural programming for the BBC. But what's important about radio is how it allows for the juxtaposition of high and low culture. And we get that everywhere in the wasteland, don't we? Marie Lloyd's Music Hall, for example, and Shakespeare, fused into a ragtime. Oh, ho, ho, that Shakespearean rag, which is a real song, which Jimmy actually managed to track down for his piece. What it reveals is the importance of the cut. What radio producers called a spangled edit, which is a way of drawing attention not to the seamlessness of one sound source and followed by another, but the way in which they come up into collision with one another. Now, this high-low nexus in terms of culture was very important for Eliot's sense of modernism. Soon after the poem came out, the pulp writer H.P. Lovecraft wrote a parody called Waste Paper, a poem of profound insignificance, and hated it, hated the Eliot, because he thought of it as a meaningless collection of phrases, learned allusions, quotations, slang, and scraps in general, which he believed, and this is, of course, ironic, believed was an index of the lowest of the low in culture, that kind of hybrid fusion of sources. But even so, you could say that in The Wasteland, like Lovecraft's fiction, Eliot was writing a series of so-called weird tales. And it may help to understand how the sequence moves if you focus in on especially the scenes that involve men and women together in some kind of situation of sexual crisis. Marie and the Archduke on the sled, Tristan and Isolde, the hyacinth girl and her lover, The way in which, for example, Philomela and Tereus, the myth of the swallow and the nightingale, is juxtaposed with its modern counterpart. The unforgettable dialogue monologue from Lil and in the pub at the end of part two about Albert and the problem over abortions and post-war sexual attractiveness and so forth. The Fisher King, the way in which the river nymphs of the Thames give us a kind of series, like Wagner's Rhine Maidens give us a series of laments over their lost virginity at the end of part three, an indelible series of little monologues from each of them. All of this indicates that it's not just high and low, but their collocation together that was Eliot's interest and that suggests some of the power of citation as a means of presenting new cultural possibility. When we think about The Wasteland, we think about its memorable images and the way these sequentially follow on one another. The dry tubers, the handful of dust, empty sea, the unreal city, a crowd of workers, the rat's alley, desperate housewives, demob soldiers, trash, winter, bird song, sex in a canoe, bats at twilight. The sequence of these motifs is all also a series of sound events, and I think we need to hear them that way. This is the sound of modernity in a taxi, throbbing, waiting. Now, it may be a bit of a stretch to make the claim that T.S. Eliot is a proto-DJ, but that is in some sense what I'm actually claiming, that he's a master at the turntables in plucking out sources and juxtaposing them together in such a way as to address something that is very profound about the experience of modernity, primarily its sense of alienation. Alienation between people, for sure, but also between people and their modern world. The sense that culture has become a series of fragments that are ungraspable and that are not there to provide us with any particular shape of coherence, but are there, in fact, to turn up the dial on our alienation. This is the kind of shock and alienation that we see represented in Baudelaire's couplet that that Eliot cites in the notes. City, swarming city, city of dreams, where in plain daylight a specter can accost the passerby. The way in which a ghost grabs on to the living person in the context of urban modernity is surely part of what Eliot's sampling is about. He is channeling the dead. Dead voices, using the medium of poetry as a means of channeling the sources taken from those who are dead, and in so doing, reanimating them, taking the voices of ghosts, unexplained agencies, the absence of power, and finding a way in which to address them as potentially current sources of power within this new realm of media-oriented poetics. The communication scholar John Durham Peters has the following to say about media. He says, the two key existential facts about modern media are these. The ease with which the living may mingle with the communicable traces of the dead, and the difficulty of distinguishing communication at a distance from communication with the dead. This is the modern difficulty. The way in which a global imaginary of possible sources is simultaneously brought into view with a history of possible sources is in part and parcel of Eliot's attempt to not just impose order on a postmodern chaos, but actually to represent that postmodern chaos in a new way. And in so doing, I think we can see that modernism is not just simply a mirroring of alienation. Modernism can help us to deal with alienation. It understands the altered social and cultural environment in which it operates as requiring a new form of address. Poetry's address traditionally was from one agent to another, from poet to reader, on a kind of one-to-one basis of intimacy. Eliot suggests, however, that modernist poetry must rise to a new challenge, a form of address that is directed not between people, but at the media themselves. Only by embracing mediated examples of the kind of commodified life that we see in the post-war landscape can modernist art hope to somehow redeem itself from alienation, alienate itself from alienation, if you like. And that, I think, is what Eliot's poem does so very well. In giving us the tools, in giving us both the evidence of alienation, it also gives us the tools for combating it in the form of a new form of aesthetic practice. But this is something that you can talk about further, I hope, in your seminars. Okay, thanks.